You sleepy or you awake? You doing all right? All right. I think we're all a little bit tired. So let's trust the Lord to help us hear and remember that very thing which is for us. And the rest of it, it's okay. I'm trusting the Lord to let you fall asleep at the right time and be awake at the right time. It's always hard to do this kind of thing right after lunch. But God is good. The very creative title of my message, people at my church know I'm terrible at making up titles for things. It's just so straightforward. So title of the message today is Death and Resurrection. Two really big words, heavy words, which are the foundation of our faith, but which I think are not as easy to embrace and understand or to practice as you might think. These are two words that define themes that should summarize every Christian's day-to-day experience. In our life with Jesus, every day there are rhythms of dying and rising to life, dying and rising to life. Sometimes we get stuck in a season where it feels like all we're doing is dying, and then other times we're in seasons where we're floating on air and there's no death in sight. We just feel as if we're being raised to life again and again. But the truth is, on a regular basis, we are supposed to experience this cycle, this dual reality, that the reason we have a hope for eternity is because of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And because of that death and resurrection, we also can participate in and through those things come to know Jesus even better by identifying with his death and resurrection. You know that that's the foundation of the gospel. And if Jesus had just died and stayed in the grave, that wouldn't have saved us. We were not saved by sacrifice alone. Thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of human beings have voluntarily, generously given up their lives to save other people's lives. Military history is filled with stories of brave, brave men and women who have done things that are so selfless. Men who instinctively jump on a live grenade knowing they will die, but the brothers that were around them will live if they will do this. That makes no sense to me. It makes no logical sense. In that split second of decision, it's a miracle that anyone on earth should give up their life for the sake of others. And that is not a small thing. That is a profound sacrifice. I've read stories of women who have knowingly given up their lives so that they can deliver a baby who could live, knowing that finishing that labor and delivery would cost them their life. I just find those kind of stories miraculous and inexplicable apart from something divine. People are too selfish to live this way, and it's not just the generosity of our hearts. I think there's some spark of the divine image in us at those moments. You know, when you see a grenade get lobbed into your trench, you don't have a lot of time to go, I feel like I should do something. And then you don't talk to your friends and go, guys, what do you think? Should we rock, paper, scissors? It's 1 second. And in that second, you are literally throwing your life away. And you just find your body in motion and you're doing it. How do you explain that? So it's not an everyday sacrifice, but I want you to know that even sacrifice like that does not save people for eternity. I think it would be amazing if Jesus took the cross for us and it ended there. That would be a sacrifice worth repeating for a long time, but it would not be a saving sacrifice. It was important that Jesus not only died on the grave, but that he beat death and rose again, because then, only then, will we know this was not just a selfless sacrifice, but this was an act of God. Only God can conquer death. And death is a great equalizer. It's the thing that reminds all of us, no matter how rich, how powerful, how young, how strong, you're all going to die, I'm going to die. We're powerless in the face of death. Every one of us, when it comes to that, may wish for one more hour, one more day, one more week. But we can't get it just by wishing. Death has power over us. And though we have a lot of money and can go to the finest hospitals, there is a limit to the way we can push away death. It reminds us that we are frail, we are limited. There's so little at the end that we can do to preserve our own lives. Had Jesus not conquered death, he would have gone down in history as just another great man who did another great thing, and we would all admire him and tell our children, someday when you get the chance, be more like him. Don't be selfish. Be selfless. But that would be it. I would be a fool to place my eternal faith, define my entire lifestyle around a man who had just made a great sacrifice. I trust Jesus not just because he gave up his life for me, but because he proved that he had the authority in beating death to conquer my own death. That when he says things like, I forgive you, I actually am forgiven. It's not just a sentiment, it's something real. It has binding force, power to do something real in my life. Only because of that have I built my entire earthly life around Jesus Christ, my Savior. That's why we cannot just settle on the death of Jesus, and we cannot settle on the resurrection of Jesus. Both are absolutely critical to understand how it is that we came to be born again, how we have our hope, and we have to, on a regular basis, touch and identify with those two very powerful truths. The Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Romans, wrote this. We were therefore buried with him through baptism into death, in order that just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may live a new life. For if we have been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. Earlier this morning, we read from Philippians chapter 3, and in that passage, Paul adds this: I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead. Now, I've chosen these two passages because I think they form an important contrast. In Romans 6, Paul is talking as though this is about the eternal rising, the dying and the rising, that once I breathe my last, that is not the end of my story. Every one of us yearns for there to be something more. I mean, this earth is pretty great. Even though it's broken, there's some beautiful things here, aren't there? Have you ever seen the sun set over the ocean? Or watched a baby sleeping and you thought, though we are sinful and broken, this world still is beautiful. Have you ever been on vacation swinging in a hammock, drinking a cool drink, listening to the surf and think, wow, it's a pretty good life? Have you ever liked someone and by a miracle you found out that they like you too? For you single people who haven't found someone, I don't mean to drum up pain, but when that happens, and it really only needs to happen one time, okay, just one time, it is a glorious, like when I found out that Jeannie liked me back, I was all prepared for a 10-year fight. I'm going to get you somehow. And I said, I like you. And she goes, me too. I didn't know what to say. It didn't seem possible. And so even in this world, there's beauty and joy. There are things that make me not want to die. And so it's greatly comforting that when this life is over, and it will be over way too quickly, life is always way too short, there's still so much I'm going to want to have seen and done before I breathe my last. I would love to be old enough to watch my children become grandparents. That's not going to happen. Probably. Who knows? But I'm so hope-filled by verses like this. But I love Ephesians 3 because what Paul is suggesting is you don't just lay hold of the death and resurrection of Jesus after you die, but that in this life, now, here, while we're breathing, this is also something we can participate in. something we can actually experience, so that through the experiencing of this rhythm of death and rising again to life, we come to know Jesus better. Knowing Jesus is not just about sentimental intimacy. It's about understanding by identifying with dying and rising to life, dying and rising to life. It is through that primarily that we come to say, I know this Jesus. I know this Jesus. Anyone who knows me back home knows that fun is a very important part of my life. I don't just enjoy fun, I need fun. I can't do things if it's all work, all serious, and there's no fun. When we went on mission trips, people got so stumbled because I was like, we're going to go serve the Lord. We're going to suffer if we need to. It's going to be dirty, sweaty, whatever. But there will always be one day where we see the beauty of this country we've come to visit, where we enjoy ourselves, eat the bounty of their good food, see their best sights, because we are not just here to labor. We are here to delight in the Lord. So you'll know me. But if anyone says, oh, I know Dave, that guy's so serious. Let's plan an event where there's no fun. It's just hard work. He'll be honored. I would say, you don't know anything about me. You can claim to know me, but if you really know me, you'll know the rhythms and the themes that define who I am. Do you want to say you know Christ? You can't claim to know him if death and rising to life are not a part of your daily experiential reality. Dying and rising are the two most important verbs that define the life of Jesus. And by dying and rising, we experience him and we come to understand his heart. So I want to be a little more practical and talk about what does that actually mean. These are beautiful theological terms, but what does it mean to participate in his suffering and to become like Jesus in his death? Some people over Christian history have come to understand phrases like becoming like him in his death as meaning you're not supposed to have fun. If you're a good Christian, you're supposed to always be a little borderline depressed. People who think this way, they say stuff like, hey, we're having way too much fun. Let's settle down. Like, how is that a bad thing to have too much fun? I think Jesus laughed a lot. I don't think Jesus went around like, oh, that cross is coming. Oh, man. I think he was that kind of guy. I picture Jesus smiling a lot. I picture him walking down the street with his disciples, and then he sees a cute kid, and he's completely distracted, and he goes, hang on a second. Come here. Come here. You're so cute. That's how I picture Jesus. He delighted in the creation that he had made. I think Jesus would have been the first guy to tell a joke at dinner. And he would have been the first one to laugh loud at my jokes. You know why I believe this? Because I am so drawn to human beings like that. People who love life, who delight in things, who are easy to befriend, who laugh readily. And I think if I'm drawn to that in a sinful, broken human being, how could I imagine God would be like all the people I can't stand?
Life hurts, and it's like,
I want to know that Jesus is like the guy who, if everything goes wrong, goes, that's okay. At least we're alive. That he's the kind of guy who takes a bad situation and he breathes new life into it. So here's a good way to think about Jesus. He is like all the people you love, and he's not like all the people that just turn you off. What is beautiful and attractive in one another is an echo of that beautiful image of God in us. What does it mean then to become like him in his death? It doesn't mean to be dour and dark. There are times when that's needed. There are times when somberness, sobriety are appropriate and necessary. There are times when laughter is the wrong response. But what does it really mean in a daily rhythm to be like him in his death? Now look at these words, these famous words. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, so dramatic, you were talking about a seed, But unless that little seed dies, it remains alone. That doesn't mean like without community. It means if it doesn't die, a seed is all it's ever going to be. It's just a seed. Unless a seed dies, it is only going to be able to say, I showed up and I was a seed. In truth, that seed contains multitudes. In truth, that seed, generations down, can become a giant field of wheat. But if it does not die, a seed is all it will ever be. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. You know, most of us say as Christians, I want to be fruitful. I want to make a difference. Have you heard that phrase? That's the new way of saying I want to be fruitful. I want to make a difference. What does Jesus tell us about how we make a difference in this world? We make a difference by dying. The key to bearing fruit in this kingdom comes through death. Now, if Jesus was trying to start a popular movement, he's not very good at it. If his goal was to create a mega church with thousands and thousands of fans following, he's really bad at this job. Because every time he was rising in popularity, he would say stuff like this, crazy stuff. Stuff that at our church we call crowd reduction statements. Jesus spoke these words at the height of his popularity. Now, you know that Jesus, over the course of his life, his popularity rose and fell. This, he said, at the time when he was the most popular, when people just loved him. In fact, he had just come into Jerusalem with his disciples, and large crowds had greeted him at the city gates waving palm branches. Do you know we call that Palm Sunday? That kind of welcome was only reserved for kings and generals who were coming back after a great victory in battle. It was the kind of welcome you gave to a king, and that's how popular he was. Every time in the past, when his popularity was growing and people wanted to follow him, Jesus always said the same thing. Do you know what that was? The hour has not yet come. His boys, his crew, they were like, Jesus, surely now we're going to make our move. Thousands of people are gathered here. They're cheering your name. They want to make you their king. Let's go. And Jesus would say, no. The time, the hour has not yet come. You know, when I was younger, I loved dancing. I loved going to parties and dancing. That's because when I was younger, I wasn't a pastor. People didn't have social expectations of me, and I felt freer inside to just be silly. And so whenever music started, I would be the first guy like, let's go, and I just, you know, I'd start dancing. Now, I find it harder to let go. Pastor Andrew, are you a little like that? Do you find it a little harder? So I go to wedding reception. I perform weddings, and then I go to the reception party after, and everyone's dancing. The music's going. Sometimes people play the music from the 1980s, my favorite music. And I'm just listening to music, and just my body starts to, and I'm like, oh, man, something's happening. And my wife wants to dance, so she's like, now? I'm like, no, not yet. There's a moment where I don't mind kind of dancing once and then running away and just going home. And so I say, no, not yet, not this song. The hour has not yet come. But then they play something like Bizarre Love Triangle by New Order, and I just cannot control myself. And then I say, oh, that's my jam right there. And all of a sudden I look at her and she knows, and I go, uh-huh. And then we get out there and we'll dance hard, and then I will run before anyone really notices me. I think it was like that with Jesus. He kept disappointing them. They're like, now? Surely now. And he would look at them and go, no, not yet. Not yet. But now, his popularity is very high, and look what he says to them. Jesus replied, the hour has come. Think about how that took their breath away. All this time, he kept saying, no, not yet, no. But all of a sudden, he goes, yeah, it's time. They were so excited. They felt it in the air. See, they believed that Jesus was going to start a revolution.
That he's going to rise to power, raise an army, declare himself to be king, and he was going to bring Israel back to the height of power, conquer Rome, become the greatest power in that region, and shake off the authority of the Roman government. They believed that's what he was going to do, and so they had tied their string to the right horse. Because when he made his move, guess who would be his cabinet? Guess who would be his inside circle? You're my boys. You're my princes. You get to be minister of this and you get to be minister of that. And they couldn't wait to become the most powerful men in Israel. So they were excited. They didn't yet understand what he was saying. But now he says the hour has come. That's what we call a pregnant sentence. Because the next one is going to give birth to something great. Everyone's waiting. Oh, whatever he says next is going to be the most powerful declaration that he's made yet. That's verse 23. This is what he says next. At the height of his popularity, when they wanted to make his move, what kind of speech do you think they were expecting? Here's what I think they were expecting him to say. Hey, boys. You remember last week, my buddy Lazarus, remember in Bethany how he was dead for like 4 days? And you watched me stroll into town and be like, Lazarus, come on, get out of there. And the dead guy got up and came out. Do you remember that? I can be death. I can take dead people and raise them up to life. Do you know what that says about me? And do you know that crowds heard about this, and now they're all flocking to me. In fact, even non-Jewish foreigners, Gentiles, are interested in me. This is no longer a local tribal movement. This is the big time. Everyone in the world wants to know me. Did you see the welcome I received at the city gates? Only kings get a welcome like that. So I think it's time, boys. We're going to raise an army. And we're going to raise the kingdom, and I'm going to be the king, and you are going to be my princes. Are you ready? Are you with me? And they would have went, yeah, like a scene in Braveheart. Rah, freedom! I think that's what they were expecting when he said the hour has come. Instead, he says, so it's like this. If this little seed doesn't die, it will become... I think they're just so confused. What are you saying? Why at this moment of triumph are you talking about dying? I think Jesus is using a very familiar image in his world at the time. Here's what he's saying. He's saying that, like I said, a seed, unless it stops being a seed and cracks open and dies, it will never be more than a seed. Let me translate it again. Here's what he's saying. If you never choose to die to yourself, then you are already everything you're ever going to become. You are extraordinarily ordinary. Because this world is full of people who will never sacrifice anything. The most ordinary thing in this world, the most common thing in this world is selfishness. Would you agree? I've visited Indonesia now, I think, 4 times. And your traffic is legendary. It reminds me of the way I picture red blood cells traveling through veins, just all like... squirming, come on, how about now? Let me just, like, that's what I'm picturing. It just works somehow, but once in a while, 2 people decide in this giant metal object, I'm gonna get that space, and neither one of them is gonna back off. Physically, it's not possible for 2 large metal objects to share the same space. Someone's gotta yield. Who's gonna yield? Aren't you so surprised? And maybe here it's more common to see yielding, because somehow it just seems to work. In the United States, when that happens, you have a traffic jam. Sometimes you have a shooting. Because I will die before I give up my rights for you. I was here first, buddy. You're crazy. I was here first. Oh, yeah?
And everyone starts pulling back their jackets, you know, because all Americans carry guns, right? And, and we just shoot each other all day long, right? It's this idea that you're surprised when someone says to you, oh, please, just go. You go first. Go first. It's so rare to see that in this world. True unselfishness. The most common thing in the world is selfishness. This is mine, not yours. I get to go first. How about me? That is the most common thing you'll find. And if you don't die to yourself, then that is exactly what you will be. You will be nothing but a capsule full of potential that never became anything more than potential. A seed by itself is nearly worthless. Maybe a mouse could have a nice snack. That was pretty good. Do you realize that mouse, by eating that seed, ate 1,000 acres of wheat if given enough time? But because it never cracked open and died, it was only a seed, and that's all it ever was. You know, I see so many people I went to university with, people who are so promising, so full of potential. They were so talented, so gifted. But at some point, Jesus asked too much. And they said, no, that's too much. I can't give that. And they pulled back, and all of that potential became nothing. I have many friends like that, who I thought were going to change the world for Jesus. And they just ended up making a middle-class income, getting bald, getting heavy, getting sick, getting old, and being utterly forgettable. Just utterly forgettable. And it's because at some point they said, I will not die. I want to live my life. Jesus says in Luke 9:23, that's not it. That's it. No, that's not it. That's it. He says, here's what it means to die to yourself. It means to deny yourself and to take up your cross every day and follow him. Another way of saying dying to yourself is this. It is to say no to yourself and learn to say yes to Jesus and yes to other people. That's what it means to die to yourself. This daily rhythm of being like Jesus in his death, it doesn't mean you just jump off a cliff. It's not always that dramatic. Sometimes God calls his people to actually die for him. That is not very common, and if that time comes, I hope we will be faithful. I always thought about that. I remember hearing a story as a high school student that out of North Korea, they were being persecuted, some Christians, and they made all the Christians to lay down on the ground, and they took a steamroller. Do you know a steamroller? It flattens the pavement, and they began one by one to roll over their legs, and after each person, they said, will you deny Jesus? And if they denied Jesus, they could stand up and walk away. They could hear the last person's legs being crushed. They could hear the sounds. They could see the blood. And the report that came out was not one of them stood up. They lay there because Jesus had given up his life for them. They would not betray him at this moment. And I remember in the 80s when I heard that story, I was so moved and I thought, and I thought as a young man, for sure I could do it too. I knew, I was sure I could do that too. I'm 51 years old now. I've lived a long life. I love Jesus, but I've also been very comfortable for the last 20 years. And on a regular basis, I think about that story and I think, if Jesus called me to die, literally, could I do it? Could I do it? If someone were pointing a gun at me and said, you deny Jesus, could I do it? I want to be able to say yes with confidence. And I hope that if that day comes, I will be faithful to Jesus.
But do you know how I know I will be faithful on that day? Because before he asked me for the big, big D death, I learned for his sake to die 1,000 little D deaths every day. You know, it's rather unfair, but sometimes we ask our teenage son, do you love us? Yeah, of course, I love you. Then will you take out the garbage? You know, let me tell you, that's really sneaky and unfair. It's actually kind of not righteous, but why do I trap him this way? Because it makes logical sense. It's so easy to say you love someone, but do you love me even enough to take out the garbage? If you won't do that, doesn't it stand to reason that I'm not sure you love me as much as you think you love me? I hope I love Jesus enough that if I ever have to die for him, I could say yes to that big death. But I'll have more confidence about that if I have learned to die 1,000 little deaths because I love him today. Self-denial is at the heart of learning to identify with the death of Jesus. And let me tell you something. Self-denial gets much harder when you become more safe and more comfortable. The man who would jump on a hand grenade for his friends after the war, 5 years later, sitting at a bar, he may not even buy that guy a beer. You buy it this time. I always buy it. The man who would give up his life in one setting when all the danger is gone and everything is safe and comfortable, I'm telling you, the safer, the more comfortable you are, the harder it is to deny yourself. But every day, God will give you opportunities to practice dying to yourself. There's this wonderful American movie called It's a Wonderful Life. Have you watched it? How many of you have not watched this movie? What are you doing with your lives? Oh, my Lord. Please stop watching garbage movies and watch movies like this, okay? This movie is worth your time. It's one of my favorite movies. There's no special effects, no aliens, no superheroes, but the story is powerful. And it's really a story about this idea of self-denial. The story is about a man named George Bailey. And he's a young man with a lot of promise and full of dreams for the future. He has ambitions. But every time he's about to take off for his life, something happens that makes him have to stay. Have you ever been in that situation? I can't wait to go away. Oh, but the store, we need you to work. Oh, Lord, the family business needs you. Oh, my Lord, I have my own life too, right? I was so looking forward to my own future, but now you're telling me to stay here. George had that life. Every time he was about to take off, something held him down and said, you have to stay here. So he stayed again and again. He put away his plans so that he could take care of his family, his father's business, and his town. He loved his family. He loved his dad. He loved the business that had sustained him all his childhood, and he loved his little town of Bedford Falls. So every time he could say yes to himself, George Bailey says no to himself and yes to other people. But you know what happens when you keep doing that? Life, I was watching the movie the first time, I'm like, when is it going to become a wonderful life? I mean, the movie's called It's a Wonderful Life, but I thought so far it's like it's a miserable life. George Bailey felt the same way, and at one point he says, I can't take it anymore. It's always not me, it's everyone else. When will it be me? And so he's got a visit from his guardian angel, a man named Clarence, who is, that's the man, his guardian angel. And at a moment, he's just a total despair. George says, I wish I'd never been born. I wish I'd never been born. And unlike most of us, George Bailey gets his wish. Clarence returns him to his town. But it's as if George Bailey had never existed. He sees his wife, who's now not his wife. He sees that his family's miserable. The people whose lives he saved by staying are homeless, miserable. They're in terrible positions. he realizes that in all this miserable self-denial, he didn't have a worthless life, but that his life made an incredible difference in the life of other people. The life he thought was worthless, that he wished had never happened, turned out to be the greatest life he could have lived. It's not the life he would have chosen, but it's the life that became beautiful in the end. So at the end, because it's an American movie, it ends happily. American movies, I think the producer goes to jail in America if you put a sad ending at a movie. So, of course, he is happy with his family, reunited, and he says, I'm glad I was born, and I'm glad I live this way because I've made a great difference in this world by being unselfish. You know, for pastors, Sunday afternoons are precious. I'm not saying this so you never bother us. If you have need, please call Pastor Andrew throughout the day. But weekends are hard for us pastors. We work very hard. We get very little sleep. And when Sunday, everything is done, the last meeting is finished, I just cannot wait to go home and be with my family, watch a football game, maybe play some Call of Duty Black Ops 4. That's right. You don't want to ever run into me online. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's my time. I've been unselfish all week. This 5-hour window is just my time. It's my turn to watch something on Netflix because I want to take a nap, to just eat something unhealthy. I don't care. It's my time. But, and on most Sundays, everyone leaves me alone, but once in a while, my phone rings. My phone rarely rings with happy stuff. Like, people, I've come to, like, hear that phone as, oh, no, oh, no. It doesn't ring because someone's going, hey, I just want to say, you're awesome, I love you, thanks. Like, that never happens. When my phone rings, and these days, everyone texts you, so when you actually get a phone call, you're like, what is happening? Something serious. And I pick it up. I have a choice in that moment. I could say, sorry, I was in something else. I couldn't pick up the phone because I was busy ignoring you. I'm sorry. I could do that. But that would be a lie. And so I'm so full of tension. I hear it ringing. Sometimes I know who it is calling, and I know it's not going to be a short one. Oh, Lord, okay. What do I do? I'm ashamed to say, twice now in 25 years, I didn't answer the phone. I'm so ashamed of that because I think I could have made a difference if I answered. But almost every other time, I answer and I go, hello? And you know what? Even though it seems like I'm being heroic and denying myself, those are some of the most powerful meetings I have. I go to this person's house and they're crying and they're pouring out their hearts, and that in that moment, I watch a person's life change. And I think if I had stayed home, I would have watched 3 episodes of a show. Not bad, no eternal value. But instead, I got to be in the room standing in front of another human being when their life changed forever. I don't think there's any contest there which one I'd rather see. It's not that easy to get there. It's like everything in Jakarta. It's probably worth it when you get there, but getting there at 4 p.m., it's a sacrifice. It's a journey. But if it's worth it, the journey will prove worthwhile. So I ask you this question. What is it in your life that needs to die? What does self-denial look like for you? Just think about this, because probably already today, there was a moment, just a moment, where God was inviting you to learn to say no to yourself and yes to Him and yes to someone else. You know that feeling when someone that you're not that close to says, hey, are you busy tomorrow? Why? 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 What's up? It's never yes. It's like, I don't know. Let me check my phone. Why? What if you just said, yes, I'm free? What do you want to do? Because that person doesn't just want to hang out with you. They want to hang out with someone. They're probably just really alone. And that moment of hesitation in your voice is just another little death for them. Oh, I see. That's okay. That's all right. You know, they shake. That's okay. I was kind of busy too. No big deal. But inside, they're hurting. Because you just told them, you're not on my list of people I say yes to automatically. You know you're on that bad list when you ask someone, you want to see a movie, and they say, what movie? It shouldn't matter. What they're saying is the movie is more important than you. Every day, we have chances to be selfless, to die to ourselves and say yes to Jesus and yes to other people. Do you know how rare that is? And how powerful it is when we learn it. And every time you do it, you will understand and know Jesus a little bit more. Because Jesus was the one who died to himself. I'm going to be here all night if I don't finish this. So I'm just one more point. Are you ready? Are you still awake? Okay, good. Let's hang on. One more. So we've learned that every day we have an opportunity to learn this rhythm of dying with Jesus to ourselves so that we come to understand his heart. And when we do, we make a big difference in the lives around us and we give him honor. But what about this other thing, this power of his resurrection? At the eternal level, at the big death level, I can tell you when I was a young man, death weighed very heavily on me. I was very uncomfortable with death. Partly because I loved life so much, the idea that it would one day end really gave me a lot of stress. When I was in grade 5, my grandmother passed away. We were living in the United States and she was living in Korea, but all through my childhood, she was the woman who took care of me. I loved my grandmother. She prayed over me every day. She taught me Bible verses when I could barely talk. And so when we got the news she was dying, we bought some very expensive plane tickets, and our family the next day was on the plane flying to Korea. But she died while we were in the air. We missed her by just a few hours. When we arrived at my uncle's house, there was a private viewing, and my grandmother's body was laid out on the floor, and the relatives would come, and they would sit with her and say things to her body that they would have said to her if she was still alive. Final goodbyes. I watched my father. He's not an emotional man, but I watched him pour out his heart in front of his mother because he had lived so far away from her for so many years, and he missed her just by a few hours. I just remember seeing that thinking, death is terrible. It's so permanent. It seems so final. I'm looking at this as a little boy. I'm looking and going, she looks like she's sleeping, but she's never going to wake up. So this idea of death has always been very heavy for me. And I remember when I first became a Christian, that was the first thing God took away, was the fear of dying. I can't tell you what a gift that was to me, that for the first time in my life, I was genuinely, truly not afraid of dying. Maybe too much so, because I've done some very crazy things since then. Climbing very high things, jumping out of moving vehicles. If there's adrenaline, I'll do it. But I remember it's that day that I thought, death is not a joke. It feels so real, so heavy, and it's coming for all of us. So when Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, the first way I experience it is for the first time I can say, I will die, but I will not end with death. My story will continue, and I will not just go out like a flame. I will continue to live even though I die. Just a week before the passage we read, Jesus, like I said, had raised his friend Lazarus from death. And before he raised Lazarus, he was having a conversation with Lazarus' sister, Martha. And here's what he said to Martha. Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die. Those were the most powerful words I had ever read when I was 15 years old. In an instant, and I mean it, in one instant, I was free. The fear of death just, it fell off me like a heavy coat, just fell off of me, and I was okay. And to this day, I'm 51 now. I'm still not afraid to die. Glory to God. You have no idea how stressed out I was between age 10 and age 15. So he says, I'm the resurrection. And what that says to us is every one of us will die unless Jesus comes back in our lifetime. But for those who are in Christ, we will live even though we die. That's our hope. That yearning for something more than this life, that's not your imagination. God put that in there to point you to the truth. But there's a second thing he says there that I want to pay attention to for the rest of our time. He says, not only am I the resurrection, which means there are dead things that will come to life one day, but he says also, I am the life right now. I am the life. What that means is where Jesus touches a person, all death gives way to life. Life rises wherever Jesus touches. I picture Jesus being like a person who walks through a dead field and behind him, plants are growing up out of the ground everywhere. I know that's fantastical, but that's the way I picture the life of Jesus. Everything he touches comes to life. Things die all the time before we die. Dreams die. Right now, we have a man in my church whose father built a great business, and because the world is changing and the economy is changing, despite his best efforts, this company is dying, and it's hard to watch. How many of you could relate to the responsibility of inheriting a business that wasn't yours, but you'll be responsible for it one day? And you'll be responsible for it in a world that is different than the world in which that company was started. It may very well be the case that that company will die while you are in charge. Things die in this world. It is a world filled with death. Relationships die. Friendships die. Dreams die. Innocence dies. Body parts die. I know that's really depressing, but I've got to be truthful with you. This is a world filled with death. Villages, families, societies die. But it's not just the fact that those things die. When those things die, something in us dies with them. Isn't that true? For some of you, you had a relationship that was very important to you in your life. And when that relationship ended, something died inside of you. It's been very hard to trust again, to hope again, to dare to love again, because something died when that relationship died. And I'm talking about two levels of death here. There are the things that die, and then the thing inside of us that dies when that thing dies. Am I making any sense? Jesus never promises us that he will resurrect everything that has died. I cannot tell this man, your business will be just fine because Jesus will resurrect it. I cannot make that promise. I wish I could, but I can't. I cannot tell the woman who just lost a baby, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. I wish I could, but I can't. I wish I could tell that young lady, that boy will come back, I promise, just wait. He will ask you to marry him next week. I wish I could say that, but I can't. He may never look at you again. Jesus does not promise that he will resurrect everything that dies. That's the reason many people feel disappointed with Jesus. They said, what is that? I followed you and then I lost a relationship and you didn't give it back to me. Forget it. I'm not going to follow Jesus anymore. He never said he would resurrect everything that died. But here's what he did say. I am the life and I am your life. I will not resurrect everything that dies, but I will resurrect you. When that thing inside of you dies, I will raise you to life again. It is possible, even though everything has fallen apart and your heart is broken and there's nothing but darkness inside, that out of that death, Jesus will raise you to life. Even if you don't get back what you lost, you don't have to die in your spirit. And that's a very important thing for some of us to hear, because something died, yes, but you also died with it. And Jesus says to you the same thing he says to Lazarus. Do you know what an absurd thing it is to stand outside of a grave and say to a dead man, come out of there? Now, do you think Lazarus was inside the grave going, hold on, Lord, just give me a second. I'm trying really hard to not be dead. I'm trying so hard. Do you think Jesus made the command and waited for Lazarus to resurrect himself? Here's the truth. When Jesus said to Lazarus, come out, his command gave Lazarus the power to live again. He didn't have to try to stop being dead. The death left him. The command of Jesus breathed new life into his spirit. The lesson for us is this. Life will throw a lot of things at you. Things will die. But you don't have to die with those things. I think for some of you, you have been dead in your spirit a long time because you lost something you thought you could never lose, something you cannot recover from. How can I go on when this is lost? My family, my dream, my business, my whatever, how can I move on when I've lost this thing? And you've been dead with that thing for a very long time. And I believe Jesus wants to say to you this weekend, he's standing outside of your tomb saying to you the same thing he said to Lazarus. Come out of there. You've been dead in your spirit long enough. I cannot always give you back everything you lost, but I can give you your life back. You can come to life no matter how hard life has treated you. In this rhythm of trusting him, hearing his command, saying to you, out of the most horrific suffering and pain, you can live again. You can live again. I met a person who had lost his legs. If that happened to me, I don't know what I would do. It'd be really hard. He had false legs, prosthetics, and he wanted to run again. And what most impressed me was his spirit. He wasn't feeling sorry for himself. But he said, this is just another challenge, a setback, but I'm alive. And I'll walk again. I won't just walk, I'm going to run again. And I thought, that is the divine spark of something. That though outwardly I am dying, inwardly, I am still alive. When you ask most people, how are you doing? They don't look in their hearts. They look at their circumstances. And if life is not going well, they say, I'm not doing well. It's possible to have lost everything and still be alive in your heart. That is the rhythm of resurrection which Jesus calls us to on a regular basis. That in the places where we have died along with our dreams and hopes, he raises us to life. Are you with me? Listen to what Paul said, and I'll end with this. Paul suffered a great deal in his life, and he said this. We are pressed on every side by troubles, but we are not crushed. We are perplexed but not driven to despair. What does that mean? We can't understand why God would let this happen, but we will not be driven to despair. We are hunted down, but never abandoned by God. We get knocked down, but we are not destroyed. That is why we never give up. Though our bodies are dying, our spirits are being renewed every day. For our present troubles are small and won't last very long. Yet they produce for us a glory that vastly outweighs them and will last forever. So we don't look at the troubles we can see now. Rather, we fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen. For the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things we cannot see will last forever. Just a while ago, I asked you, what is it inside of you that needs to die? Where do you need to embrace the self-denial that is at the heart of Jesus? I'll ask you a second question and end. What is it in your life that needs to come back to life? Is it hope? Is it the willingness to trust people again? Is it daring to love someone after you've been hurt? What inside of you died when something important to you also died? And I believe Jesus stands in front of you now and says, don't stay in the grave. Come out. Let him raise you to life 1,000 times in this life. And one day when this life is over, you will be raised with him for eternity. You cannot know Jesus without deeply knowing these two rhythms of death and being raised to life, dying and living, dying and living. We can choose to die to ourselves, and we can submit to and trust God to raise us to life again, dying and living. That is how we come to know Jesus. And you know, many people have asked me, Pastor, how can I get closer to God? This is an answer right here. How can you get closer to God? Learn to die and learn to come back to life over and over and over again. I'm going to stop talking before half of the room completely goes to sleep because you guys are looking stretched. But I hope for those of you who hung with me the whole time, you will hear what I'm saying to you. Knowing Jesus is different than knowing most people. To know Jesus, we must walk as he walks. You cannot know Jesus by studying a book alone. He is not that kind of person. To know Jesus, you must walk as he walked, so that in the experience of dying and being raised, you understand who he is and what he is like. And I promise you, if you willingly die to yourself and you experience him raising you to life, you will say at the end, I knew him. I really understood him, and he knew me. I have been praying a while before coming that for some of you, this would be your wake-up call. That thing in you that's dead, don't stay there. Come out. Today is the day God invites you to stop living in death and walk out. Trust him again. Hear his command. He says to you, get up from there. It's been long enough. And his command will give you the ability to rise.